Well, welcome everyone to another edition of the Brownson Group. Today, we're going to be talking with Dr. E. Michael Jones, the author of a book called Libido Dominante, Sexual Liberation and Political Control. Hello, Dr. Jones.
Hi, Dave. How are you?
All righty. This is one of the most powerful books I believe I've ever read because it puts into context a lot which has happened in our contemporary society. And it explains even more, as you're about to tell us, about the history of the West for the last 200 years. Now, one of the basic theses of your book here is the idea that sexual liberation could be used as a form of control, that it's at the very heart of the story of Samson and Delilah, which we remember from the Old Testament, goes way back, and that the idea that sin was a form of slavery was central to the writings of St. Paul. What is it, sexual liberation, political control, what is it, why is it relevant today? How do we see it now?
Well, it's one of the best forms of control because it's the subtlest, because it masquerades behind your passions. So what it is basically a manipulation of human passion. And human passion is powerful, and it blinds you to the fact that you're being manipulated. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is that the culture is absolutely now, this is a question. I don't know whether people are blind or whether we're talking about deliberate repression of people who understand the story, but the culture is absolutely adamant in not allowing any type of explanation of pornography along these lines. There is absolutely no discussion whatsoever along these lines. And so the only thing you're allowed to talk about is freedom. So people who, if you're against pornography, you're against freedom. This is the way the debate has been managed for over 50 years now. Let's say 50 years from the Roth decision.
Now, what was the Roth decision? That was
it was just an obscenity decision that basically opened the floodgates to pornography in 1957.
Pornography, free sex, sexual license.
Because up until this time, pornography had never been considered a First Amendment issue. And obscenity was never considered First Amendment. And this was the opening of the door to allow pornography to be considered a First Amendment freedom of speech issue.
So sexual license, then free sex, free love, whatever you want to call it, then becomes an issue of freedom. It becomes an issue of liberation in the dominant culture.
Yeah, yeah. So in order to really understand it, the real dynamics of it, you have to take a step back and you have to look for examples. And I think the best example that I can come up with was the instance of the Intifada, the battle between the Israelis and the Palestinians. In 2002, the Israeli military force marched into Ramallah. And after they did that, they took over the TV stations, which is pretty much standard procedure. But after they did that, something unusual happened.
What was that?
They started broadcasting pornography over the TV stations.
Oh, they're liberating them.
Well, this leads you to a question of, well, why were they doing that? Now, I've mentioned this in talks I've given in Europe and Africa and in the United States. And in two of those three instances, there were Palestinians in the audience who came up to me and said that they were there when it happened and told me details about it that I didn't know. For example, that there were snipers on the roof of the hospital in town, and they imposed a curfew. And if you went out, you got shot. So you had to stay in the house. And when you stayed in the house, the only source of information you had was the television. And the television is now broadcasting pornography. First one station, and then basically all three. All the stations but one got taken over. And the one station that didn't get taken over broadcast in one of those little bands across the bottom of the screen that they've been taken over by the Israelis and they're broadcasting pornography. So, you know, don't, this is not something we're doing. It's beyond our control. So the question is, why did they do that? And if you go to the American contemporary culture and you look for an explanation for the purpose or the reason for pornography or what pornography means, you there were two fairly recent cultural artifacts that explain it for you. The one is called The People versus Larry Flint, Hollywood movie. And the other one was called Boogie Nights. And both of these appeared around the early 90s, and they appeared at that particular time for a particular reason. That's because at that time Congress was debating something called the Communications Decency Act, which was whether to allow pornography on the Internet. And this was the pornography industry's cultural offensive to make sure that they were allowed to use the Internet to distribute pornography. So you go to a movie like The People versus Larry Flint, and Woody Harrelson, for some reason, they picked him to play Larry Flint. I don't know where. I guess Jabba the Hutt was had other obligations at that time. But anyway, they got him to play it. And during the course of the movie, he says that no one is free in this country unless I'm allowed to produce pornography. And so that's pretty much the explanation. Pornography equals freedom. So if we take that explanation and we apply it to what happened in Ramallah, it's pretty clear that the Israelis were trying to bring freedom to the Palestinians.
Well, but your book and your thesis is that that's really just a euphemism for a very sophisticated form of slavery.
Well, I think anybody in his right mind knows that the Israelis are not interested in liberating the Palestinians unless we take liberation in a contemporary cultural sense. And so you have to look someplace else for the explanation. And I'm saying the real explanation can be found in places like, you know, the story of Samson and Delilah in the Bible, which is also set in Gaza. So nothing has changed in that regard.
So the idea is to get people to watch pornography or accept pornography, whether it's in the United States or anywhere else. Once they start doing that, then their passions will determine how they live their lives.
Yeah.
And the people who present the pornography will make money because people will want to feed their passions. And as these industries make more money, they'll be able to exert more influence on the society.
Right. Right, that's pretty much the thing, the explanation. So to begin with our example, everyone's supposed to be distracted from the fact that the Israelis have just taken over your town because all you're going to do is watch pornography now. And that's pretty much what the Shin Beth and the CIA had in mind when this thing was proposed in the first place. So I think that makes pretty clear that that's the military application of pornography. It's a weapon in cultural warfare, and the group that controls the pornography ultimately ends up controlling the mind of the country where they have settled in. And so what happens, what you see here, is that the same thing happened in the United States in a less dramatic fashion over the course of the 1960s, when the people, the Catholics, fought. Catholics have been fighting Jews for 30 years at that point over obscenity. The battle over obscenity in the United States was a Catholic-Jewish battle. Usually Irish Catholic attorney generals fighting Jewish Hollywood pornographers or New York pornographers in the early years. People like Samuel Roth, who was the guy who was involved in the Roth decision in 1957.
Yeah, you mentioned something about culture, and culture is a very important aspect of human life, and it's also a very, I guess you could call it, like Clausewitz would call it, a center of gravity to certain people. It would be kind of one of their resources that holds them together, and if you can corrupt that or change that, then you can control them.
Yeah. So the battle is over who controls the cultural settings in America. And the battle was basically between the Catholics and the Jews.
Now, this battle wasn't necessarily fought by a political regime. It seems like what you're saying, that there were industry, in reading your book, there was industry that was involved, there was academe that was involved, and occasionally it would spill over into the legal or the political arena. Is that pretty accurate?
Yeah, I think that what we're talking about is moral and pre-political. In other words, if you can control this aspect, then the politics sort of follows naturally from that. Because, first of all, you've established the parameters of control. You've established the idea that control is something that is acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
And it's acceptable because it's not perceived as control. No one perceives this as control. Everyone, I mean, there's the libertarian argument, you know, like, well, if you don't like it, well, change the channel. You know, this type of thing. That's not the issue. The issue is who gets to determine what's on the channel in the first place. And once you get that, once you control that, then the other stuff just sort of falls into place naturally. And that was the genius of the people who were involved in this thing. They knew that the moral, let's say, sexual settings preceded the cultural settings, and the cultural settings preceded the political settings.
Hmm.
And so if you control, it's like this narrowing, you know, slice of pie. You know, if you get to the center of the circle, it's a small piece. But it radiates out from there and covers a wide area by the time it reaches the circumference. And that's what we're talking about here.
In your book, you talk about roughly 200 years of history, and you talk about a number of individuals and specific events in history where these default settings were being adjusted.
Yeah, well, the main adjustment of default settings is known as a revolution.
Mm-hmm.
So the first revolution I deal with in the book is the French Revolution, because it was in many ways the biggest, it's not the only revolution, but it was the biggest revolution, the most significant revolution in the modern era. And what I'm saying here is that it's based on St. Augustine. He's the one who said that a man has as many masters as he has vices. He's the one who proposed the alternatives, and the alternatives are the city of God and the city of man. And the city of God is based on love and service to your fellow man. And if that's the case, then the city of man has to be based on the opposite. And the opposite of that, love and service, is libido dominandi. I got the phrase from Augustine's City of God.
It
means the desire to dominate other people, the dominating desire, the lust to dominate other people. And so once you turn away from the city of God, which is what France did when they killed the king, there's only one other place to go. And so what you have to do then is dedicate yourself as a part of this new culture to dominating other people.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you see after this, beginning with this period for the next 200 years, is the use of freedom, first of all, as the prime way to dominate people. And secondly, what the culture becomes involved in is more and more refined techniques of domination. Because, you know, if you really want to succeed, you've got to be subtle, because no one likes to be dominated.
At least not overtly.
No, that's why the use of the term freedom is so important here, because it becomes the justification for more and more sophisticated and elaborate forms of domination.
What they're talking about a lot of times, the freedom, is a release or a removal of any sort of obligation to others or to God or to morality.
Yeah, it's usually the standard liberation is, I am going to liberate you from the bondage of morality. Well, morality is another word for reason. It's called practical reason. And so if you liberate a rational human being from reason, you're turning him into a slave or an animal. And that's what happened here. Lots of people, I don't know whether it's most people, but lots of people feel that the only thing freedom means is the ability to gratify their passions.
Mm-hmm.
And so these people know that, and so the regime then becomes the guarantor of your ability to gratify your passions. And so you gain regime gains the allegiance of a certain group of people, and they become the commissars one way or the other, either by getting paid, as in the case of university professors, or just, you know, normal people who chew you out for expressing bad ideas, which is to say, you know, where you stand up for some, for the moral law in one way or another.
Now, it's important that your use of the word term does not necessarily mean political. It could mean the socioeconomic, intellectual, cultural.
Yes, that's right.
I mean, I think a lot of people think of regime, they think political, but as I read your book, I got the sense that, it's beyond political. It's pre-political, as you said earlier.
No, it's more cultural than it is political. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's obvious that universities are part of the regime. It's obvious that the media is part of the regime. They tell the story the acceptable story. And the acceptable story in this regard is that, you know, pornography means freedom. Everybody, you won't get anywhere if you don't express those views, because the regime won't let you get anywhere.
You indicate that if you don't go along with those views, you either get patronized or you get ignored. If you go along with the views of sexual liberation, but then you change your mind, then you're in a lot of trouble.
Well, then, the first way that this culture deals with you is called dynamic silence. If you're at a low level, people will organize, the groups who are organized to enforce the code of the regime will make sure that no one knows about you, or they'll try to make sure that no one ever hears your name, or your name never gets mentioned in newspapers unless it's part of character assassination. And even that now has character. These are technological issues, so character assassination is pretty much switched over to the internet, where all this type of crap gets published on you. And then if push comes to shove, one of the commissars, the local commissars, can cite something on the internet saying something bad about you that will confirm everybody in their belief that you're a wicked person. But that's, in a sense, we're far down the road, you know, that the original appeal of sexual liberation has sort of failed.
Really?
I guess, I think so. I mean, I think it was in the 60s where it was had its most its greatest appeal. And then once it gets established as the norm, and then people start to defect or wake up or lose enthusiasm, then that was the rise of political correctness, I think, which was a more rigorous form of political control that began to arise in the early 90s. So I think that by the early 90s, people were starting to wake up, or just, you know, they didn't like the idea of how it had become pretty onerous, you know, under this. And so then they started enforcing it in a more draconian fashion.
Well, wait a minute. Now, you're saying that then people got tired of the idea of sexual liberation. They said, we want to return to you know, sexual morality?
Yeah. Well, you're talking about the course of a whole generation now.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, to get specific, this was when my son was at Harvard. And he and his friends, most of whom were Catholic, came up with an alternative magazine called Peninsula.
Mm-hmm.
And the issue at Harvard in the early 90s was homosexuality.
Okay.
And so these guys said pretty much, well, homosexuality is sinful and it's bad. And, you know, it's the usual stuff that you would expect from Catholic kids. And they were denounced, you know, violently by every good-thinking, upstanding person at Harvard University. Well, that's a sign, in a sense, that the whole it's failed. They failed because it's not supposed to get that far.
They failed. Okay, who failed? You got to explain.
Harvard
for me.
Failed.
Harvard failed in doing what?
Let's say Harvard, as the commissar of the regime of sexual liberation as political control, had failed in their education, because the whole point of education is that you are supposed to internalize. This is not real education. The whole point of social engineering as education is that you're supposed to internalize the commands of the people who are running the operation. And since Harvard had gone over lock, stock, and barrel to this revolutionary explanation of things, everyone who went there was sort of, you know, you're admitted to this exclusive club and you're supposed to espouse those ideas. You're not supposed to protest against the very ideas that the reason you're there, the reason you as a Catholic, a benighted Catholic ethnic from some, you know, middle class, lower middle class family in Indiana, the only reason you're there is because we see some potential and you're supposed to adopt Harvard's ideas.
Hmm.
And then when you start this magazine and you say that homosexuality is a sin, you're how stupid can you be? You're not supposed to do this. So you've committed a sin against etiquette by doing this. But what you're really saying is that the real source of the anger is that they perceive that these kids are ungrateful. They're supposed to, you know, this is Harvard, man. You're supposed to act as if you're part of the establishment now.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the establishment means that you're supposed to espouse homosexuality as the greatest thing that anyone could ever aspire to.
Hmm.
I mean, if there's ever virtuous behavior, it's sodomy, isn't it?
Well, I suppose that's how a lot of the cultural mandarins would have you.
Well, it's clear that that's what you were supposed to think at Harvard. It even replaced racial, you know, the racial ideas of the 60s, you know, like the civil rights movement. This was the next extension. I mean, after feminism, it was sort of like civil rights, then feminism, and then homosexual rights, and that was sort of the cutting edge of the zeitgeist. And you sinned against the cutting edge of the zeitgeist by saying that it was wrong.
Mm-hmm. Well, these kind of things, like the Peninsula magazine, kids at Harvard like your son and others who are standing up and espousing traditional morality and the Catholic way of thinking must also be a cause of concern for this socioeconomic cultural elite. And so they deal with it, like you said, by imposing this strict code of political correctness. What else do they do? Are there other things that they do?
Well, that's just the beginning. The rest of it is, you know, you can't get a job in any form unless you're willing to espouse this type of liberation. Now that's a blanket statement, and it's wrong to a certain extent because there is a reaction does arise to these things. Nothing happens without a reaction, and the reaction was conservatism to some extent, but then you see the conservatism gets co-opted over a certain period of time. And that's, you know, that's another whole story that we could talk about another book,
right.
You know? So I guess what I'm talking about here is, like, you know, I get, you know, in many ways the book Libido Dominandi is the book that I wrote during the Clinton years.
Right.
And I guess Clinton is Bill Clinton is the best expression of sexual liberation as political control. He was the epitome of this. He was the baby boomer who was a total slave of his passions, and therefore he was a total slave of the people who could manipulate his passions. And so there was a reaction to Bill Clinton, and that was known as George Bush, and that's a whole other story. You know what I mean? You could talk about that as a whole other story. But let's talk about, I mean, I think, you know, in many ways, Bill Clinton is the culmination of Libido Dominandi. I think even if I had written it 100 years from now, I probably would have ended with Bill Clinton because he so epitomized, you know, the whole Monica Lewinsky thing sort of epitomized the whole thrust that began with the Marquis de Sade, you know, with the French Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
He was the baby boomer. He's 2 years older than me, but he's basically that generation who got totally swept away by the sexual liberation of the 60s and sort of made a career out of it.
Mm-hmm. You said earlier, and you indicate in your book that from the French Revolution until the time of Bill Clinton, that the techniques of domination have been ever more refined. Can you give us a summary of what you mean by that?
Yeah, there are two aspects. One of them is technological. So if you begin with the Marquis de Sade, it's probably the first man who articulated the whole idea of sexual liberation as political control, or the, let's say the political implications of sexual liberation. He has this passage which he wrote as, in a speech to sort of, you know, get the keep the revolution going in the face of the threat that the Vendée, the Catholic reaction, posed at that time, 1795. And he said, what you need for a Republican government, and by that he means revolutionary government, is to exhibit the women naked in the theaters. At this point in time, state-of-the-art pornography was basically etchings. And so you had etchings in the Marquis de Sade's sort of pornographic masterpiece, Justine. And that became a famous book. I think it was Byron and Shelley. It figured in their lives and the creation of Frankenstein, which was in many ways the reaction to the French Revolution. Mm-hmm. But there was a technological limitation there. First of all, the etchings are not very realistic. Mm-hmm. And secondly, when it comes to actual, you know, women in a theater, you got a technological problem. Either you got a real big theater, in which case the people in the back row, you can get a lot of people there, you can affect a lot of people, but the people in the back row probably can't see very well. Or you get a small theater in which everyone can see well, but that's not a whole lot of people. So what happened is that over this period of time, technology really became the driving force behind pornography. And so then you had photography, which was a big step forward in terms of realism, and then you had moving pictures. And so by the time of the 1930s, the next great philosopher of this use of pornography was Wilhelm Reich, who said that he could, you know, corrupt women's morals if he could expose them to a mass situation. Because then everyone felt that everyone else was doing it, and so they didn't feel so bad. So mass situations were things like Woodstock was a mass situation. It was a Dionysian festival, mm-hmm. which had a big impact on the baby boomer generation.
It breaks down barriers when you see other people either talking about it or doing it, and it seems like now it's sanctioned. It's approved by whoever the powers to be are.
Yeah, so it's okay. So you don't feel guilty about what you know, doing something that you know is wrong. So the most recent example of this mass situation would be something like the Vagina Monologues, which we have dealt with in detail over the past few years. Yeah. The first performance here in South Bend was at St. Mary's College, in which they had a nun leading the girls, chanting words like cunt and so on and so forth. And I wrote an article on that, and that got that thing canceled, but the revolutionaries who have taken over Notre Dame and St. Mary's then staged it at Notre Dame instead. And then it became a battle. Every year they're going to have the Vagina Monologues. Every year some alumnus from Cleveland is upset and writes a letter to first Father Malloy. It was Father Malloy for the most part,
right,
who then said, hey, it's academic freedom.
Right.
Academic freedom, which is basically shows you that this Catholic priest has internalized the commands of his oppressors, because no one before 1957 ever thought that obscenity had anything to do with speech, right, or freedom of speech, or certainly not academic freedom, you know, because that's even a higher level than, let's say, newspapers. But anyway, so he diddled around, and then finally they got a new president, and the new president capitulated totally and utterly to the revolutionary forces on campus. And you know that story better than I do.
Well, though this past year, of course, they kicked it off campus, and it remains to be seen whether it'll ever come back.
But it doesn't have to come back now. This is the whole point. You know, the revolution succeeded. The Jenkins administration has totally and fatally compromised itself, and so they don't need it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
They don't. What point would it make anymore? You know. But the whole point of this was to expose, to corrupt the morals. Let's put it this way: take a step back. The reason you're chanting all those dirty words is to break down the modesty of the young people who are doing the chanting.
Right.
And why do you want to break down their modesty? Well, as a prelude to control. Control is the only thing that explains this.
There's a couple of levels of assault here that you're talking about. The one level is against the individual. you know, these students, they get chanting the word, or they run naked through the dorms. And so what you do is you change their behavior, and by changing their behavior, you change their belief, value, or system. And then the second line of assault seems to me that what you're saying is that it's against the structures that are supposed to protect these individuals, that are supposed to advance the truth, namely universities that may call themselves Catholic or even the church itself.
Yeah. That Reich saw that perfectly clearly in, when he wrote about the situation in Austria in the 1930s. He saw that the sexual constitution was absolutely crucial to the political constitution.
Really?
And so, sure, it's in his book, The Psychology of Mass Fascism. Hmm. Or the words, The Mass Psychology of Fascism.
Mass Psychology.
Sorry, I got the title wrong. But anyway, what you're doing here is everybody knows that everybody has passions, and young people have passions that are more unruly than other people, older people. Less ability, less practice in keeping them under control. And so if you get them to act out on these things, you will have created a fifth column within your institution, if it's a Catholic institution, and these people will be the lumpen proletariat. They will be the foot soldiers of the revolution. So what you see, I give a talk on this, explaining what I'm trying to explain now and the way it functions at Notre Dame. And you got all these young ladies who are in the gender studies program who come and listen to my talk. And you can't make a dent. You know, they have been so brainwashed by the gender studies ideology that, you know, let's put it this way. I cannot make a dent within 45 minutes that I have to give this talk. They have become dedicated soldiers of sexual revolution, which means they are a fifth column that can be turned on and off like a spigot or a light switch by the revolutionaries to be used against people like the Holy Cross priests who if they haven't lost it completely, are losing control of their institution.
All right.
I mean, Jenkins' administration was over before the semester was over, the first semester there. Because he gave the speech on academic freedom in which he said, yes, the vagina monologues fall within the purview of academic freedom. In other words, chanting dirty words and talking about what your cunt smells like, that's all academic freedom. But I would never allow, he said, the performance of the Oberon Regal Passion Play. Well, I mean, what else do you have to say? It's over. I mean, if that's what your idea of academic freedom is, you should seek employment elsewhere.
Now, you make in your book, you spend some time writing about recent events. By that I mean the last 60, 70 years, things that have happened in this country. You spend some time talking about the Rockefellers and about the Reverend Hesburgh at Notre Dame and the assault on Catholic teaching on sexuality and contraception. You also spent some time in the book talking about psychology. What is psychology is a science, right? I mean, Freud was a scientist and all that.
Well, what you see here is that libido dominandi is in many ways a history of modern psychology. But what you learn after a while is that modern psychology is not psychology. It's really one form or the other of psychological engineering. In other words, it's techniques that you can use to manipulate people, to get what you want out of them. In other words, it's classic libido dominandi. And so let's say begin with Freud. Freud practiced... Freud, in a sense, had some grounding in traditional psychology. In other words, he understood the topography of the soul, which was reason, will, and passion in that hierarchical order. He just changed the words to superego, ego, and id. Okay, but he was grounded in it. But what he did was he used it as a form of control on a one-to-one basis.
Right.
That's what psychoanalysis was. And so what I cover in the book is basically Freud trying to get money from rich Americans. I think that was the big battle at the beginning of psychiatry. It was basically Freud and Jung doing battle over who would get the rich Americans. And so in this regard, Jung, who was the goyish prince in what was basically Jewish science, won. He got Edith Rockefeller McCormick and Madel McCormick, her brother-in-law, to come over to Jung, and Madel had problems with guilt, and so Jung said, "That's okay, you know, just come and talk to me." And Edith gave him $6 million. Now, $6 million in 1910 or 11.
That's a lot of money.
That's a lot of money.
Yeah.
That's a lot of money. That's real money back then. And so he built a building, and basically Freud was furious at Jung, and this was the big break in psychoanalytic circles. But Freud was no different. He had a guy, in order to become a psychiatrist at this time, you had to be psychoanalyzed by Sigmund Freud himself. And so there's an American doctor by the name of Horace Frink, who was associated with Johns Hopkins. And he went over, and during the course of the psychoanalysis, he told Freud that he had this sexual attraction to one of his patients. So what does Dr. Freud say? Dr. Freud says, well, divorce your wife, marry this woman who happens to be very rich, because they're the only people who were doing psychoanalysis at that point, and then give me some money. Make a big contribution to me.
Well, I mean, he'll feel better, right?
Does it take a genius to figure out what's going on here? I mean, Freud at one point said to Fleiss, the other nutcase that he was dealing with, Fleiss believed that everything, all your psychological problems were associated with your nose. Okay? So anyway, he lived
crazy
in Berlin, and Freud lived in Vienna, and Fleiss invited him to Berlin, and Freud wrote back and said, I'd love to come, but I'm afraid my patients will get well in my absence. Now, this is the type of person that Freud was. He liked to control people.
Yeah.
So, all right, that's one branch of psychology. Then there's the American version, which is John Watson, which is behaviorism, the control is so overt here, I don't know why we have to talk about it. You know, it's basically John B. Watson was this white boy from the South who just loved hanging around the farm and dealing with animals, you know, chickens and pigs and whatever it is, you know, and he was a genius at training these chickens and pigs to do things, because it's all, when you're an animal, it's all basically stimulus response. You don't really think things through if you're a salmon. You know what I mean? You don't think, geez, I love that salmon over there, and I think I'd like to have sex with her. You know, that's not the way it works. You have chemical reactions that go off, and you start swimming up the St. Joe River. And you fertilize the eggs, and then you die. That's it. There's no free will involved in any of this type of stuff. And so Watson felt, well, if it works for animals, it works for human beings. They're animals, right? Aren't they? Well, Watson was the darling of the Rockefellers. And if he hadn't run off with that 19-year-old girl who was his student, he probably would have continued to get Rockefeller money, but he got fired from Johns Hopkins. And so they needed another control guy, and they found him in Kinsey.
Kinsey from Indiana University.
Yeah, none other. And he wrote, and the Rockefellers, World War II breaks out, and it's just about to ruin Kinsey's ability to do what he was doing, his sex surveys. And he needed this guy, this assistant from South Bend, Indiana. So the head of the Rockefeller medical wing wrote a letter to the draft board saying, we need this guy because Kinsey is doing things that are absolutely essential to learning how to control civilian and military populations. So they said it right there in the draft board letter. It was control.
Yeah.
And then the final thing is the third way, which is, you know, Maslow, Rogers, and those people. That's psychology. And it turns out, well, that's a form of psychological warfare, too. And the proof of that was basically the whole story of Carl Rogers and the Immaculate Heart nuns in Los Angeles, where he just came in and destroyed the nuns using sensitivity training. So no matter where you turn, the whole history of modern psychology is a history of libido dominandi.
It's the history of being controlled by someone who's able to manipulate your passions.
Yeah, I think that's pretty much it. I mean, you know, okay, you could say that Watson, maybe there's an intermediary step there, but it came down to Eddie Bernays, who was Freud's nephew, taking Watson's idea about instinct and then combining it with Freud's idea of sexuality, and you come up with advertising using sex to sell you stuff. So one way or the other, what you need, what they realized, the controllers realized, is that you needed a sexually permissive culture. And so the big enemy in this regard was the Catholic Church, because by the time of the Legion of Decency, let's say the late 20s, early 30s, the WASP ruling class had given up. They had all gone over to the dark side. I mean, as a group, they had gone over to the dark side.
They were engaged in sexual license, contraception, all that. That's what you mean, right?
Yeah, the Anglican Church finally capitulated to sexual revolution in 1929 when the Lambeth Conference approved contraceptives.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, contraception became a virtue. Mm. You know, if you had a lot of children, you were sort of wicked. And once contraception became a virtue, it was only a matter of time before sodomy became a virtue. And that happened, around the time my son was at Harvard in the 1990s, early 1990s.
So the societal powers, the culture shapers, if you will, Freud, others in the media, these people are themselves given over to passions. That's part of your thesis, right?
Sure. They're all like Bill Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
In one way or another. So, Freud, everybody knows now that the Oedipus complex is guess what? It's this sort of hidden protocol of his affair with his sister-in-law. It's even in Spiegel, the German magazine. Everybody knows now that when he went to that resort in the Alto Adige, he consummated that relationship. And so basically what you have in Freud's writings are the longest sort of unacknowledged autobiography in psychological history.
So he's trying to justify what he did.
Yeah.
The wrong he did.
Yeah, he said at the Oedipus Conference, every man desires to have sex with his mother or sister. I mean, to be honest with you, when I first heard that, it wasn't immediately apparent to me. I mean, it's not like, two right angles is equal to 180 degrees or something like that. It just was not immediately apparent to me. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought, well, there must be some type of statement he's making here. And it turns out the statement he was making was about himself and his infatuation with his sister-in-law. And that became a kind of numinous thing with him by the time he wrote Moses in Monotheism, because he started thinking of himself as a god. And, the pharaoh was a god, and the pharaoh had, married his sister because no one else was worthy of this type of thing. And so incest becomes this thing. And basically, he got the idea for incest from, the Illuminati manuscripts, Byron and Shelley, and that goes back to the French Revolution again.
Well, Freud was an evil man, keeping an evil tradition alive. But then it got expanded with the assault in society, really against decency in the form of the Catholic Church, and that you talk about. Well, that rose in the 40s, 50s, 60s. This guy Paul Blanchard had a lot to do with it too. You write in your book.
Yeah, he wrote American Freedom. What was it called? American Freedom and Catholic Power.
Right.
Book in 1949, which was a compilation of articles that appeared in The Nation during 1947.
Mm-hmm.
That was the Paul Blanchard, as he said in his autobiography, became a total devotee of sexual liberation sometime during the 1920s. He was a minister who became a demagogue, a cultural demagogue. Most of the ministers became psychologists. So Protestantism became psychology at some time around that time during the 1920s, 30s.
Which is a form of control, becomes a form of control.
Well, they didn't know that, but I think it was. That's exactly what it was. I mean, John B. Watson studied to become a minister, and then he became a psychologist under the influence of John Dewey, who had just left University of Chicago and gone to Columbia. So it was a kind of like a paradigm shift, where the Protestants decided that they didn't believe in this stuff anymore and switched and created a different religion, and their different religion was known as psychology. And that became the dominant paradigm for this whole middle of the 20th century. So, of course, they're not going to be able to defend morals because they don't believe in morals. Now, by Protestants, I'm talking about, you know, the WASP ruling class and the schools that they established. The South was a whole different situation. The South was a conquered nation. And let's say in 1915, you know, every summer they would put the guys who fought in the Civil War would put on their gray uniforms and march down the street.
That's right.
So they had the consciousness of a conquered nation. So they were really not part of this completely, even though John B. Watson was. But he became a Yankee when he went to the University of Chicago.
Mm-hmm. The attack on the church took a lot of different forms, and you talk about that, but probably one of the most pernicious forms we alluded to earlier was to try to get a fifth column established.
Yeah.
Try to buy out some key leaders.
Yeah.
Charismatic leaders.
Yeah. Yeah, and Theodore Hesburgh was the man, the paradigm of this sellout. I mean, as I said, that the battle over obscenity was a Catholic-Jewish battle, but
right.
The battle over birth control was a Catholic-Protestant battle.
Mm-hmm.
That was the WASP ruling class, epitomized by the Rockefeller family. And the scion in this regard of the Rockefeller family was John D. Rockefeller III, who founded the Population Institute in 1950, but he got involved in this in the 1930s, and he got involved in it basically because the Catholics beat the Protestants on birth control. And by beat, I mean that the government was going to get involved in birth control in the 1930s, and the Catholics, people like Monsignor Ryan and the Catholic bishops, beat them. And the government did not get involved. So this was like the high point of Catholic cultural influence, the 1930s, when basically the Legion of Decency got started and Monsignor Ryan defeated Margaret Sanger in battle in the American Congress.
Mm-hmm. But what was the secret to Catholic success back then, as far as you're able to tell? And perhaps that's also the secret for the Catholic disintegration beginning in the 60s.
Yeah, poverty and solidarity. And the combination of those things was the ethnic neighborhood.
And the culmination was that ethnic neighborhood with the parish in the middle.
Yeah, this was this is actually Paul Blanchard and his brother Brand spent a summer in Bridesburg in Philadelphia in a Polish neighborhood, and they said it was just absolutely impenetrable, and these people will never become Americans. They just gave up and walked away in disgust. So that was it was sort of a group solidarity based on coherent local communities where the priest had a role of spiritual leadership, and where the bishop was not afraid to antagonize other groups. For example, Cardinal Dougherty called for a boycott of the Warner Brothers theaters in 1934 in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody knew this was a battle between Catholics and Jews. Everybody knew that.
Mm-hmm.
And the Catholics won. And the Jews had to put in place the production code in Hollywood, which existed for 31 years until 1965. So what happened during the early 60s, coincident with the Second Vatican Council, the Jews and the WASPs started looking for people to collaborate with. Collaborators is the word that was used for the people in France who worked with the Nazis. And I think it's an apt term here. And Hesburgh was a collaborator.
Right.
So what happened is that John D. Rockefeller thought that Vatican II would be an opening to change the church's teaching on birth control. And so what his people, Cass Canfield, who was on the Population Council, I think also the head of Planned Parenthood in New York in the early 60s, arranged to have a series of secret conferences at the University of Notre Dame from about 1963 until 1965. At which they specified, pretty much told Hesburgh, we want you to change the church's teaching. They didn't say it that bluntly. It was just going, hey, we're going to explore the issue and blah, blah, blah. But then they also said, look, you're not allowed to invite these people. Father Zimmerman was one of them who's not allowed to be invited because he was a promoter of, you know, natural family planning. He was an opponent of contraception.
So once again, we're seeing very sophisticated control saying, you know, we just want to explore this topic.
Yeah, we're just, and we'll give you money. We'll give you money. The Rockefellers are going to give Notre Dame money. And if there's one thing Notre Dame loves, it's money.
Yeah, well.
And they love the idea, like Kinsey. Hesburgh was like Kinsey in this regard because he felt that by associating with the Rockefellers, he got credibility, a credibility that he didn't have just by being some Catholic priest.
Do you think Hesburgh was trying to advance the Catholic faith, the Catholic religion?
I think he was trying to get money.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what he wanted, money and prestige. That's what he wanted.
There seems to me that in talking about Paul Blanchard and his trip to the ethnic neighborhoods and opposing that with Ted Hesburgh and Notre Dame, that there's been a real falling away from the spiritual and an embracing of the material as the primary means to, as the primary purpose of life.
Well, the word would be assimilation. And so there were people who felt that the Catholics were an unassimilable minority. Certainly Paul Blanchard felt that way.
Mm-hmm.
But by the 1960s, there were people who felt that, no, we can work out some modus vivendi between Catholics. And the man who was the man who came up with the theoretical justification for that was John Courtney Murray. And he wrote a book called We Hold These Truths, which I think is not a bad book. I mean, he says that the essence of America is morality. And at the end of the book, he said if that constitution were ever threatened, Catholics could withdraw their allegiance. Well, that's exactly what happened the minute he appeared on the cover of Time magazine. You know, he was sort of the paradigm of the American Catholic during Vatican II, when we no longer feared the modern world and blah, 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 and so on and so forth. And what happened is that Catholics got taken to the cleaners politically. They lost all their political power.
Even though John Kennedy was elected president about that time.
Yes, that was the culmination of Catholic political power. So the culmination of that arc that began in, let's say, 1934, when Cardinal Dougherty organized the boycott of Warner Brothers theaters in Philadelphia, you could take that to its apogee by going back to Philadelphia in 1962. July 4th, 1962, Independence Square, Philadelphia. You have on the platform there a Catholic president of the United States, a Catholic governor of the state of Pennsylvania, and a Catholic mayor of Philadelphia.
Hmm.
Now, that was sort of the high point of Catholic political power.
That's pretty powerful. They have all Catholics there.
Yeah.
But to a degree, they had to sell out, or they had to give up the faith. Is that a fair statement?
To a degree, yes.
Hmm.
Although Kennedy, I mean, you know, it's still an open book. He did do that speech to the Dallas ministers,
right,
which was not a good explanation of the relationship between church and state from the Catholic perspective.
Right.
But on the other hand, I think that John F. Kennedy was the last man, or let's say maybe next to the last man, who felt he had a mandate from the American people, as opposed to a mandate from the rich and powerful, who paid his campaign expenses. So, I mean, the epitome of that would be Bill Clinton, who was like this piece of poor white trash from Arkansas who got a Rhodes Scholarship and so as a result had been anointed by the powers, and then he just carried out their bidding by, you know, like NAFTA, GATT, those things, which sold out the interest of the great majority of the American people and the Democratic Party, but that's not who he represented.
Right.
Whereas John F. Kennedy, I think, did feel he represented the American people, or certainly had a mandate, and I think that's probably why he got killed. But that's a topic I can't really get into because I don't know enough about it.
Let's jump back to John Courtney Murray here. He said Catholics could withdraw their allegiance.
Yeah, that's the last page of the book.
That's pretty powerful stuff.
Yeah, he said it's conditional, and it's conditional. In other words, America was not a Catholic country, but it allowed for the free expression of Catholic religion because it had this sort of moral framework. And he cites de Tocqueville and so on and so forth. John Adams is not cited, but John Adams said, we have no constitution that functions in the absence of a moral people. So in a sense, we're all different Protestants, you know, Presbyterians, Baptists, Catholics, whatever. But we all accept these certain moral principles because they are the principles of the natural law. Well, that got changed. That got changed during the 60s.
Right.
I mean, when you're dragging abortion, I mean, for God's sake, if there's anything that is so obviously a violation of the moral law, it's abortion. And now that's what you have to defend. And Notre Dame has to defend it. You know, they got into the business by defending birth control. And now, you know, and then by the 70s, they were defending abortion and pornography. So, and now they defend homosexuality. And now they defend, you know, there's nothing they don't defend that is part of what the regime once defended. And that's all the length and shadow of one man, and that's namely Father Hesburgh. He's the one who changed the settings at Notre Dame.
Well, his 90th birthday party was just held. I don't know if you had been invited to that.
I wasn't invited. I thought you would be invited and could tell me.
I did.
You're
in London,
aren't you?
I am. I got something in the mail. I considered contributing, but that's the extent of it.
Yeah.
But we're getting down to the end of our time. You know, this is just a wonderful book. It explains a lot. It's very sweeping in its scope. It shows, I think, to a lot of us the foundation for a lot of misery that people are suffering today. As we get to and that foundation, I think, is this, is that it's not the sexual liberation was not bottom up. It was top down directed. All revolutions are top down directed. As we get to the end, any comments here or thoughts that you want to leave the audience, right? Or any comments there about what I said about revolution, sexual liberation? Anything you want to say here, Michael?
Well, it is the genius of it is that it does take into account the psychological situation of millions of people, because everyone's born with unruly passions, and you have to spend your lifetime using reason to control them. And so it does appeal to the fallen man and in all of us. And so that's part of its genius. The trouble is that it's always, you know, it's always a situation that gets out of control. And so the sequel that I wrote to Libido Dominandi was Monsters from the Id, which is about horror movies, and which is about how this experiment never works. This is this kind of like the standard horror movie story is the experiment that got out of control. And that's the story of our culture.
It's out of control.
Yeah, it's gone out of control. And I guess one of the best examples would be the whole trajectory of the civil rights movement ending up with this destruction of the black family. How that happened, which I go into detail in the Libido Dominandi as well. But horror is the expression of that. In other words, horror is the expression that it didn't work out. And so what happened, like in 1979, everybody thought, you know, Alien is this great movie. Well, why? It's because now oral sex is dangerous, and everybody knows it's dangerous. That's the whole message of Alien.
Really?
Yeah, and they loved the movie because it really told the truth in a way that all this other sexual liberation propaganda was not telling the truth. And that's why horror became such a force in the popular culture for the next, I'd say, 20 years, let's say from Alien or Halloween all the way up to Wes Craven's Scream movies, which were basically parodies of the slasher genre.
You're saying that these motion pictures touched something that people were feeling as a result of this culture that had gone off the tracks.
Yeah. Yeah, they knew that it was bad stuff. They knew they had been hurt by it, but they couldn't say it because, you know, if you say that you're hurt by the sexual revolution, you know, you don't get into Harvard, or they say bad things about you. So, you know, that was the bind. That's why horror is so important, because it articulates something that you can't say openly.
It's like a release valve.
Yeah, it is. That's what the monster allows you to say what you really want to say.
Huh.
So it's cathartic in that regard.
Well, let me ask you, if it's out of control, where does it go? What has history shown us that when things like this get out of control, and you've got an amazing ability, you know, to pick up on these, I think you'd call it these Whiggish operations that have ended up going off the tracks. And do they ever get back on the tracks? What happened?
No. Once you get on the road of empire, you never get back on the tracks. So you just enter into a period of decline. And something else takes the place of the empire. So Rome was an example of that, you know, where Europe took the place of Rome because Rome entered this period of decline because, you know, empire, the constitution of empire is libido dominandi. You're dominating other people. There's no sense of common good or anything. It's just domination. And eventually you come across someone you can't dominate, and they dominate you, and then that's the end. So it's not a very optimistic scenario.
Dr. E. Michael Jones, thank you very much.
Thank you, Dave.